Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the first public testimony from anyone directly involved in 9/11 interrogations, a former FBI agent has directly contradicted claims by the CIA and by former Vice President Dick Cheney that enhanced interrogation techniques work. Here's Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse questioning former FBI agent Ali Soufan, who told senators this morning that his by-the-book questioning worked on al-Qaeda suspect Abu Zubaydah when he was captured in 2002.
Your testimony indicates that within the first hour of your interrogation of him, you had gained important actionable intelligence. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And it was during your questioning of him at the hospital that you elicited information regarding the previously unknown role of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks.
Correct, sir.
Soufan said that he then watched as a CIA team with a private contractor arrived and Abu Zubaydah shut down and did not reveal any more information under harsher techniques. It's the first congressional hearing since Bush-era torture memos were made public last month. Joining us from outside the hearing room is Carolyn Lockhead, a Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. And Carolyn, just tell us some more of what you heard today that jumped out at you.
Well, it's just riveting testimony, not only from Ali Soufan, but from Philip Zelikow, who was a State Department lawyer fighting this battle within the Bush administration, urging against the use of enhanced interrogation techniques.
And what more did Ali Soufan, the FBI agent, say about his thoughts about the two different kinds of techniques he talked about, one by the book that he did and the other that he witnessed the harsher?
Well, it's pretty shocking. He said inexperienced outside contractors came in and violated basically everything that the FBI and professional interrogators know about eliciting information. He says it doesn't work, it takes too long and squanders valuable time if there's an imminent attack, it does not save lives, in addition, of course, to violating our legal and ethical standards.
He also seemed to have been saying in previous reports, ABC News, for one, has reported on his previous statements that he questioned what's going on here. Who authorized this? Did he get to that today?
Not yet, but they're working on that. But he was basically thrown off the case after he found out, he said, within 1 hour about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, about whom authorities had no information, and also about the dirty bomber Padilla, who was threatening a radioactive attack on Washington.
He seemed to be explaining why he felt that the harsher techniques didn't work, that the contractor, the outside contractor for the CIA, had to keep going back and request harsher and harsher techniques. He explained it's because the suspect had been trained to call his bluff and withstand the techniques. But did he say who the contractor was asking, if he could use harsher techniques?
Well, we assume that's the White House. There was constant requests and then, of course, briefings of Congress to escalate because they were ineffective. That's what's so interesting about this. Because the terrorists, as you said, were trained to withstand exactly that and knew that they could call the bluff of the interrogators, that in a democracy you can just go so far.
Well, in earlier reports, this FBI agent said that he wrote a memo about his distress, about what happened. He says that that memo was lost. But let's get to a secondary storyline running here, because the release of the CIA documents and this whole issue has engulfed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a political firestorm about whether or not she was told about waterboarding in 2002. And we know that Republican Senator Lindsey Graham alluded to that today, questioning whether today's hearing was a political stunt. Tell us more about that.
Well, ironically, it's the release of the torture memos that the first victim of the political victim has been the House Speaker, because Republicans have quickly turned this to who knew what when. If Pelosi and other Democrats were so outraged at the time, why didn't they say anything? That's now the question. There's the reason this has got such steam behind it is there's moral outrage on both sides. The Republicans feel it is totally unfair after the fact and completely out of the context of 9/11 to question decisions that were made under fire at the time. Democrats are saying we violated our basic, not only laws, but ethical standards of all kinds, and you cannot allow this to happen. This is like the Japanese internment after World War II. It's just wrong, and we have to find out what happened.
Well, meanwhile, in just the few seconds we have, Carolyn Lockhead, it sounds as if the testimony today from the FBI agent adamantly against the harsher techniques was quite compelling.
It was very much so, and so was Philip Zelikow's.
Carolyn Lockhead, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Obama emphatically said today that health care reform has to happen this year, and it must include reducing health care costs. And yesterday, the government released a report saying the Medicare Trust Fund would run out of money by 2017. Well, today we want to take a look at how Medicare money could possibly be saved and potentially far better care could be delivered to people at the end of life. Now, it's a conversation that may be difficult for some to hear. We're going to hear from people making life and death decisions, and that's part of the problem. It's a topic people don't want to hear or talk about. But the government spends a third of the Medicare budget on patients in their last year of life, a third. And millions of people, like 73-year-old Patsy Sabella, her family, and her caregivers, are struggling through that year.
How do you feel today?
Lousy.
Tell me.
I can't.
You can't breathe well.
I can't. It's hurting me bad.
It's hurting me.
No, I see it. I see it being uncomfortable.
Okay. Patsy, if you want to give you more morphine, we can go up. It's going to probably make you sleepier.
And you may not be able to talk to your kids when they're here.
Yeah.
But if that's what you want, we can do that.
Okay.
That's a scene from the new public radio documentary Quality of Death, End of Life Care, Inside Out, in which reporter Rachel Gottbaum takes a deep look at how Americans die. Rachel joins us now. And let's start with the story of Patsy Sabella. She was at Mass General Hospital here in Boston, her family, you know, doing everything to try to keep her alive despite her pain. Your documentary concludes there might be a better way to approach death. Tell us about that.
Well, basically, Robin, what we found out is that we spend so much to keep every single patient alive, no matter what, no matter who they are, and we're not asking patients what they want. In Sabella's case, she's a typical American consumer. They moved from Florida to Boston to get care at Mass General. They got the most aggressive care, and as Patsy is dying, they're still asking for radiation treatment, which they did receive 2 days of radiation treatment. This really is symbolic of how many Americans view healthcare as a cure for death.
But you also say that doctors play a role in this. How so?
Well, the medical culture is about cure. It's about treatment. Doctors are not necessarily trained on helping patients die. In fact, one of the things we found out is that few doctors are trained in how to treat pain. Diane Meyer, who is one of the pioneers of a specialty called palliative medicine, talks about how American medical providers are not trained in when to stop treatment and when to help patients die. And what changed for her, why she became a palliative care doctor, is because she told a story about a 68-year-old man with lung cancer who had turned down chemotherapy, radiation, but nonetheless, his family found him in the apartment, was unconscious from a seizure, and then he was rushed to the emergency room.
The doctors placed a tube that went from his nose into his stomach because their fear was if they didn't give him food and fluids, he would die. He kept pulling the tube out. So then they tied his hands. Then he managed to get the tube out with his knees. Then they restrained his feet. And in fact, he spent the last 31 days of his life tied to the bed, pulling hard against the restraints, screaming, crying, moaning.
Dr. Diane Meyer with a horrific story. She's at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, and she says she found out that the interns treating that man said they were doing everything they could to keep him alive. Well, that led Dr. Meyer to become a pioneer of palliative care. These are healthcare professionals who help people make end-of-life decisions, and part of that is helping the family work through these decisions. Rachel, tell us about that.
Everybody has a different agenda, including the doctor, the sister, the mother, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And palliative care physicians come in and help the family come together to talk about, what do you want to do now? We need to prepare for the end of life. How do you want to do it? They have something called a family meeting. And I had the opportunity to tape one of these with Dr. Rochelle Bernacki, who's a palliative care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She brought together a family where the mother had advanced colon cancer. One of the daughters is on the phone.
We also had the surgeons come, and they also feel that surgery is not indicated and that it would be too risky. So,
are you talking a couple months at this point, or is that something you can't even answer?
I think I'm concerned that that's probably where we're at this point. I think that that's probably realistic.
A couple of months?
Mm-hmm. I think we're probably in that time range.
That's a tough conversation, but Dr. Rachel Bernacki, who we heard there helping to counsel a family, is behind a movement to have those tough conversations. What else does a palliative care provider do?
Well, palliative care helps patients determine what kind of treatment they want to have, may also interpret what their doctors are saying. The oncologist may spend 15 or 20 minutes with the patient. The palliative care physician is there for 45 minutes to an hour to help them figure out what the diagnosis means, what the treatment means, that they may have options, and also to help their family understand this.
Does insurance pay for it?
Yes, it does.
Hmm. Well, we know that palliative care can touch on some controversy in families. Some people see it as giving up. Some family members aren't ready for it. It sounds as if this is part of their expertise, you know, helping families deal with those issues. But what's the research on palliative care? What does it show about the impact?
Well, you know, there's resistance to palliative care because doctors see when you bring palliative care in, it's giving up hope. They're the doctors of death. And palliative care is trying to show that actually you want to have patients be able to have curative treatment and also a good quality of life and plan for the end of life, not wait until basically they're in crisis in the hospital and no one's had this conversation. There was a recent study out of Dana-Farber, the Journal of American Medical Association, found that patients who had end-of-life conversations, terminal ill cancer patients who had end-of-life conversations, were less likely to get aggressive care, more likely to go into hospice, and reported better deaths. Their families reported better deaths. Their families grieved less.
That's Rachel Gottbaum. Her public radio documentary is called Quality of Death, End of Life Care Inside Out. So as she's saying, you know, people don't get palliative care, but they often wait too long to get it. When we come back, we'll hear about a program to provide palliative care to patients as soon as they get their diagnosis. And we'll also hear the story of a terminally ill cancer patient who, ironically, found out that he could start planning for the rest of his life only once he decided that it was time to die. That's in about a minute. But coming up later, savings and loan programs in rural Africa. Is microfinancing better than aid, a handout, or will it introduce poor people to debt? Back after our break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been speaking with reporter Rachel Gottbaum about her public radio documentary, Quality of Death, End of Life Care, Inside Out. And Rachel, as we've been hearing, you know, one of the main themes of the film is the emergence of palliative medicine. This is the idea of having a guide through the end of life. And you also looked into a pilot program here in Boston that offers palliative care to patients early on, as soon as they get, for instance, a cancer diagnosis. Tell us about that.
So basically, studies are mostly medical studies on whether cancer treatment works, for example, chemotherapy. And these doctors want to show that palliative care helps patients and saves money. So one patient, 73-year-old Josephine Monty, who took part in this early palliative care study. So remember, upon diagnosis, she got palliative care support. She decided to postpone her chemotherapy to go to Florida.
I said, I want to go down and see my baby grandson down in Florida. He's 12 years old, but he's got autism. He looks for me. He says, naughty grilled cheese. Those are the words he uses.
That's the words that I would use, too.
Naughty grilled cheese when he comes in the house.
Well, and Josephine Monty sounds like a, you know, a pistol. But she was worried about that decision she made. She was worried about telling her doctor that she wanted to forego care. And that's one of the tensions, I would imagine.
Yes, because there's actually pressure to get care. And what the oncologist who designed this study said is that it's much easier for the doctor to give more chemotherapy as opposed to talking about, well, look, you've made it to Disney World. Maybe it's time to go into hospice. Those conversations are more difficult. So a lot of times we're opting for very expensive medical treatments as opposed to talking about the inevitable.
Well, it seems like a pretty basic idea, you know, to not waste the last few days and weeks and months that you might have with aggressive care if, in fact, you know you're dying, and to do things like visit a grandchild. But it's often not that kind of a decision that has to be made at the end. It's whether or not to have CPR, whether or not to be put on a breathing machine, and sometimes the patient isn't able to make those decisions.
No, the family makes those decisions. But what the research is finding is that you want to have those conversations before you're in crisis in the hospital, because otherwise somebody else is making them for you, often healthcare providers who don't know you. We also found that do not resuscitate orders are often ignored. We visited one new type of healthcare, which is providing primary care, which is where people say these conversations should happen with the primary care doctor, but the primary care doctor does not have time. There are programs in place that provide primary care to seniors where they live, so that they stay out of the hospital and they stay out of nursing homes.
As part of primary care, not emergency care.
That's exactly it. So I went and was able to visit Dr. Adam Burrows, who is the Boston PACES medical director. This is his home care organization, visiting his 85-year-old patient, Al Bell, at his apartment.
Many of my older patients say, well, if that were to happen, if I were to have a cardiac arrest and my heart were to stop working, let me just go at that point peacefully. Other patients of mine say, well, no, try everything you can to keep me alive no matter what kind of condition I'd be in. So it's a very kind of personal decision, depending upon what your views are about where you are in your life and how you see dying. So do you have any thoughts about that?
I'll give it a shot.
So you would want
see what happens.
So you'd want us to attempt resuscitation under that circumstance.
Yeah.
But if things did not go well, you'd want me to speak to your family about whether to continue breathing machines, intensive care.
It didn't work. It didn't work. So I'd be cremated.
Okay.
Rachel, your documentary, again, Quality of Death, End of Life Care, Inside Out, gives us a really deep look at some of the most intense personal moments in someone's life. And if you don't mind, we'd love to visit one of those moments with Henry Schaefer. He was dying of lung cancer. It was very quick. And you say that it was palliative care that actually helped him confront what was happening to him.
Yes, Henry Schaefer was a lung cancer patient whose demise came very quickly, and he was on the early palliative care study. And so when the cancer went to his brain, that was his first conversation about death with his palliative care provider. And as it was explained to me, is that he was able to really look at his options and figure out what he wanted to do with his future.
Things came into focus in a way that they hadn't in the past. It's like having an epiphany.
This epiphany, how would you describe that?
A sense of future. I'm looking forward to the spring. I was thinking about, like, the word April.
That's remarkable, you know, to be thinking about your death and what you think about is April. Well, Henry Schaefer did pass. You went to his funeral. We'll hear some sounds of that. But also hear his friend Tim Sullivan, who took care of Henry during his illness. Let's listen.
Henry realized that death will come, and you will probably never really be ready for it, but you can be as ready as you can be by making sure that you are aware of everything around you and how important it is, how important the people are. I think he was able to achieve that by the time he left the earth.
Rachel, did you see that across the board? Did you see the things that you say studies show us, that families who are able to have palliative care, to really talk about the end of life instead of aggressively fight it, that they fared better?
Well, what I saw was that patients who had resisted really felt supported. So, for example, I followed a patient who was a surgeon at Mass General who had resisted palliative care and got palliative care, and basically it said it was a lifesaver. This woman did home visits, and these patients had the kinds of support that they said was invaluable.
Reporter Rachel Gottbaum. Her public radio documentary is Quality of Death, End of Life Care Inside Out, produced with George Hicks and Anna Benstead at WBUR here in Boston, our home station. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, who's in charge? Who's running the show in Afghanistan, in Iraq? We'll learn about the military leaders charged with ending two wars. And we'll also explore the final frontier of Star Trek fandom. You do have your own Captain Kirk chair, don't you? That's tomorrow. Back after the news, Here and Now. Ten states and the District of Columbia ban drivers from sending text messages or texting from their cell phones, and dozens of other states are considering bans after a slew of news stories. Last year, a bus driver in San Antonio, Texas, was caught on tape texting before plowing into an SUV in front of him. No one was seriously injured. But a train operator in Los Angeles was texting before a crash that killed him and 24 others. That was in September. A 13-year-old on a bike was killed by a texting driver here in Massachusetts last December. And last week in Boston, a 24-year-old trolley operator texting his girlfriend rear-ended another train, sending dozens of people to the hospital. We know it's dangerous, so why do people do it? Dr. Michael Siegel is a behavioral and social science professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. Welcome, Dr. Siegel.
Thank you very much.
We know that the Government Highway Safety Association says every study shows that texting is as dangerous as driving drunk, but people still drive drunk. So is that, you know, the same reason why people still text?
There's a really irrational component of human behavior, and there is something in psychology that's called the optimistic bias, and I think this explains why people do these kind of behaviors. The optimistic bias basically is that people recognize that a behavior is harmful, but they don't think it's going to happen to them. They think, well, you know, I'll do it in a safe way. I'll still pay attention while I'm texting.
And are you of the mind that they, I mean, I know you're coming at this from a social science point of view, but are you of the mind that others are, that is, it's really impossible to text and be safe? We're reading that it takes at least 3 seconds to send a short text message. And in that time, you could have traveled the length of a football field if you're on the highway. And we're hearing from experts who say it's just impossible to do that safely.
Yeah, there's no question that it's physically impossible to be texting and have your eyes on the road.
So where's the disconnect here? I mean, if people know that it's not safe, it makes sense that it's not safe, what is that part of their brain that's giving them that optimistic feeling?
Well, the disconnect really comes from the fact that people's behavior is not rational. You know, we're all kind of led to believe that we weigh the risks and benefits of our actions, and that if only we're aware of the risks of our behavior, we won't do it. The reality is, though, that people are able to rationalize anything. I mean, it's not the case that the people who are causing some of these accidents are people who are, you know, inherently criminals or stupid people. I mean, these are people who are intelligent people who recognize the risks, and they just don't think it's going to happen to them. And this is why the law is such an important motivating factor, because people will follow the laws, and you can't do it with just education, and you can't do it with just persuasion, because people will convince themselves that it's just not going to happen to them. And this is why with any kind of traffic safety issue, whether it's wearing seatbelts or other forms of distracted driving, people are not going to do the right thing unless there's a law telling them that they have to.
Well, in fact, I realize I've been exhibiting some optimistic bias as I've talked with you because I keep talking about them, these other people who do this, text while driving. And I've used a cell phone while driving, and that's not that much safer.
It's also a risky behavior as well. I mean, it's arguably not as risky as texting because in texting, you absolutely have to be looking away from the road.
I guess what I'm saying is that if people are listening to this and saying, yeah, them, those people, it's probably many of us as well.
Exactly. I think that this is something that a lot of us do. Even people who, like myself, work in public health, we're aware of the risk. We do studies on it. And yet many of us engage in the same behavior. So, you know, we're not talking about people with some sort of bad intent. We're just talking about a natural human tendency to rationalize our own actions and to think that, you know, it's not going to happen to us.
That's Dr. Michael Siegel, behavioral and social science professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. Dr. Siegel, thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, as always, we'd love to hear from you on this story or anything on the program. Just go to our website, hereandnow.org, where you can click on Contact Us and send an email or call and leave a message, or you can leave a comment right there on the homepage. That's hereandnow.org. Before we go today, some terrific Mississippi blues made modern by the Hill Country Review. Back in half a minute, Here and Now. The word microlending became somewhat a household word in 2006 when Muhammad Yunus, an economist and banker in Bangladesh, won the Nobel Peace Prize. Yunus and others believed that a small loan to a poor person, someone who wouldn't qualify for a conventional bank loan, could help lift that person and their family out of poverty. The loan would allow them to start a small business, earn income to pay the loan back, and save some money. Some people say microfinancing is more empowering than just handing people aid. Well, microlending is now done the world over in South Asia, Latin America, even the Bronx. It's morphed into microfinance, which includes savings and loans programs as well as insurance and other financial instruments. And it's very much happening in Africa, where the group CARE has an ambitious plan to have 30 million people participate in microfinance programs in the next 10 years. 70% of those participants would be women. Lauren Hendricks is overseeing the program. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And just make the case for microfinancing. How do you see it helping Africans?
Well, microfinance has a proven track record of really moving people who participate out of poverty. And it does it in several ways, by increasing their household incomes, but also by enabling them to invest in assets that they can use in, over the long term to improve the welfare of their households and their families. It also has a proven history of enabling households to invest in education, to invest in health care of children. And these are long-term solutions to poverty.
Right. They have exponential value. Just describe for us how it works. I mean, we know that Muhammad Yunus was very successful in a very densely populated country, Bangladesh. Here you have Africa, very rural, people spread out.
Yeah, and that's why the methodology that we're using in Africa is a little bit different from what has been successful in places like Bangladesh, India, Latin America, where the population is a little bit more dense. So in Africa, much of the growth in microfinance has been based on a model called savings-led microfinance, where women are put together in groups of about 20 to 25 people. They save a small amount on a weekly or a monthly basis, and then they're able to borrow out of that pool to meet their household needs.
And is this the Village Savings and Loan Association that we've heard of?
That's right. That's what this is called.
Well, and it sounds wonderful on its face. But you know there have been critics. Vijay Mahajan, for instance, he runs a rural financed institution. He worries, first of all, that with these groups, because everyone depends on everyone else to do well, that it has actually led to violence if some women don't, because they're, you're nodding yes, because they're relying on each other. But then he also goes on to say that microlenders are wrong to think that the poor want to be entrepreneurs, want to be self-employed. What they really want are higher wages and jobs, not more debt, which is what a loan is. So respond to some of that.
Well, much of what Vijay says I actually agree with, that debt as the first financial service product, especially for the extremely poor, is inappropriate. When you think of the very, very poor, they're extremely risk averse. They don't, if they take risks and they fail, they don't have any safety cushion to fall back on, which is why we think leading with savings rather than leading with credit or leading with debt is more appropriate, especially for the very poor. We start these groups before external microlending starts. So the groups are started only with the women's internal savings. Any borrowing that they do comes only from their collective savings pool.
So that these are women who have a little bit to pool together to begin with, and that's how they start. You set them up as a group, and then down the road, they may get microloans.
That's right. That's right. And they'll get microloans from their own savings pool, but external loans, loans that come from an outside source, they won't get until down the road.
Way down the road. But even then, you know, the success rate for even upper-middle-class entrepreneurs, at least here in the U.S., it is not high. I mean, you know, entrepreneurship is about being willing to fail quite a bit. Are people who are living on the edge, maybe they have a little savings, as these women do, are they ready for that rate of failure?
Well, I would say that, first off, it's not a one-to-one choice. The jobs simply aren't there. But I would also say that these women aren't participating in new kind of startup entrepreneurial activities. Many of them are involved in agricultural activities or agricultural trading, things that they've always done. They're just able to do it at a higher level now.
Well, give us an example of how this might work in, let's say, rural Niger. Describe a group that's going.
Yeah, so a group might come together. They would go through a six-week training process, and then they would start to save. And many groups save as little as a dime a week. And then after about 3 months, when the group had built up enough of a pool, women would start asking the group for a loan. And those loans could be for anything. They don't have to be for enterprise. They can be for household consumption needs as well. It's important to note that it's not that the poor don't have any money. It's that they have very cyclical income cycles. So there are times when people earn, and then there are times when they're in deficit. So part of what the system does is allow households to smooth that process. So they're able to save when they have excess, and they're able to borrow when they're in deficit.
Do you come face-to-face with these women?
All the time.
Yeah, what do they say? How do you see them affected by this?
It's very interesting because you see them go through a process from being very meek and quiet in the early stages to being very active and empowered in the later stages. And so you'll see women get very demanding with their local leaders about what they expect and what they want to happen in their communities. And that would have never happened before they had that practice of engaging in their groups.
Well, and I'm wondering, you know, just a social question. Again, we mentioned Vijay Mahajan, who was concerned that sometimes within these groups there can be violence towards women who aren't saving enough or somehow pulling the group down. Have you seen that happen, or have you seen another thing, which is sort of upsetting the social order apple cart?
I haven't seen so much violence among the group's women towards each other. What we have experienced, and it's important to note, is that this can lead to, microfinance in general, can lead to increases in tension within households, which can lead to increases in domestic violence. And it's really important to note that when you start changing the family dynamics of who's earning income and who's controlling income, that can happen. And it's one of the reasons a group like CARE is sort of well-positioned to do microfinance. We can bring in sexual and gender-based violence programming alongside of a microfinance programming to address those issues.
Or even be preventive, maybe talk to males about, you know, that it's okay if a woman's also helping with the finances?
That's exactly right. And in Burundi, for example, we have a male change agent program, which identifies men who have changed their attitudes towards their wives and towards domestic violence in their household. And then they run radio programs similar to this, explaining to their friends and their neighbors how they benefited from changing their attitudes towards their wives.
And what's also fascinating to us is that here you are doing this lending program that's based on savings while we're watching the entire, or just about, you know, most of the lending programs in the U.S. and in the West collapse, in large part because people overreached or didn't understand the finances, or it seems the whole thing got too big. As you observe what's going on, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that we were right to start from the place of savings rather than debt, because certainly that's one of the things that we've seen in the U.S., that this over-indebted culture that we have wasn't sustainable. and that cultures based on savings do seem more sustainable. Many of the economic problems we're having right now are based on this credit market that doesn't work and that doesn't get credit where it needs to go. And that's the way that poor people in developing countries have always had to run their economies without access to the basic financial services that we sort of all take for granted every day.
That's Lauren Hendricks. She's executive director of CARE USA's microfinancing program Access Africa Initiative in the States for a visit. Lauren, thanks for dropping by to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
It is hard from the start.
That's the song You Can Make It from the new CD by Hill Country Review. The band is an offshoot of another group, the North Mississippi All-Stars, which started with a jam session slash performance at the Bonnaroo Festival in 2004. It was such a hit, they released a live CD of that performance. And now, Hill Country Review is on the road promoting its first studio CD, Make a Move. They call themselves a modern blues band, but their sound is deeply rooted in classic southern rock and traditional blues. In fact, Gary Burnside, son of the legendary Mississippi blues man, the late R.L. Burnside, wrote You Can Make It and several other songs on the CD. Before a recent show at the Paradise Club here in Boston, Here and Now's Alex Ashlock caught up with Hill Country Review members Cody Dickinson, Kirk Smithart, and Daniel Coburn. Daniel said this song has particular resonance for him.
When Gary was teaching me the song, he told me that a lot of the things that his dad told him are included in the song, like, you know, what don't kill you make you strong. And so it kind of hits home because I was always an RL fan, and, you know, being close with Gary and him sharing, you know, what the song's all about, you know, and it's a lot of the same things that my dad has told me. So it just kind of takes me home.
Now, Cody, you're usually sitting behind the drums for the North Mississippi All-Stars. And as I understand it, you guys put together the material that's on the new CD really quickly.
You know, everything has happened very quickly for this band. Like, we immediately hit the road, and we were recording our rehearsals, which ultimately some of those songs became final recordings for the record. We were just blessed and lucky enough to get some attention from the radio and good reaction from people, you know, of course, fans and music lovers. And the Hill Country Review are very excited.
Yeah, I love my baby all by myself. If my baby loved me all to herself, we're hanging in there. We're hanging in there. We're hanging in there. Hanging in there like a dirt shirt. Hanging in there like a dirt shirt. Hanging in there like a dirt shirt. Hanging in there like a dirt shirt.
Kirk, what do you enjoy about playing with these guys?
The musicianship is unbelievable. It's a great bunch of songs, too, you know, and the crowds are very responsive to what we're doing. And not to mention I get to rip up some solos every now and then. Me and Cody are very heavy on the guitar solo thing in this band, and that's definitely a big backbone. It's a lot of camaraderie, too, a lot of good friends. Just playing really good music.
Daniel, you play harmonica on the CD. Who did you listen to growing up, or where does your style come from?
My dad used to listen to a lot of Jay Giles Band, so Magic Dick, I'm a Lickin' Stick. But the funny thing is, I used to play open blues night with Larry McRae. You know, I showed up with my bullet mic and my little amp, and he said, you don't need this, you know, you just play the horn parts. So what I initially did was just played what I heard was the horn part. You know, like Motown songs, there's always a horn part. And Larry kind of put that right in my head, and I've always played it that way. I don't overdo it. It's tasteful, I think. You know, it respects the music. Harmonica can get pretty annoying if you play too much of it, so Larry McRae taught me pretty much to lay low.
Kirk, what about your guitar playing? You know, who are your influences?
As far as blues goes, my earliest blues influences were Jeff Healey, Ronnie Earl, you know, obviously the superstar, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Hendrix, and that kind of stuff.
Tell me about Hill Country. Where is Hill Country?
You know, it's the Delta blues in Mississippi are you know, world famous, and there's a very kind of distinct region just south of Memphis. It's the Hill Country in Mississippi, and the style of blues there is completely different. It's not like your 12-bar typical 1-4-5 music structure, and it's not based on a shuffle either. It's more of a backbeat-driven, like hypnotic, kind of a one-chord trance-like music. After about 10 minutes of it, you know, the girls start to dance dirty and people start to drink moonshine, and you got Hill Country Blues.
We are coming to your town to rock and roll and get down. We can't wait for the show. We want y'all to know.
Just one more question. Where do you guys see this little project going?
World domination.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
The easiest question of all to answer.
Growing up in Mississippi taught me a whole lot of things.
Cody Dickinson, Daniel Coburn, and Kirk Smith Hart, members of the band Hill Country Review. Their new CD, Make a Move, is now out. They spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Without
funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.